Welcome to episode 9 of the Marion Vermeersen podcast. Today I'm talking with my friend Eric Rickert. He is a knowledge work infrastructure consultant, a director of the Kirkwood Meadows Public Utility District, an avid hiker, a passionate San Francisco Giants fan, an explorer, a scholar, and a traveler. Eric began his professional career as an architect, and then, after earning an MBA from the UC Berkeley School of Management, he joined Sun Microsystems and became the vice president of Sun's Workplace Research and Development Program. Largely through Eric's leadership, Sun created an innovative work program called iWork that contributed to Sun's success and ability to attract and retain the best and the brightest. In 2006, Eric left Sun after 17 years and formed his own consulting company, designing and developing physical, IT, and policy infrastructure to support contemporary knowledge work. He splits his time between his homes in Palo Alto and Kirkwood, California. I have known Eric for over 10 years. I first met him when I joined Sun's real estate organization. Later, I worked for him in the iWork group. As I was preparing for our conversation, I found a recommendation on LinkedIn that for me precisely describes Eric. His colleague and friend, Joe Owe, said of Eric, "Few really earn the term thought leader, but Eric is always several steps beyond everyone else. He and his iWork group at Sun Microsystems have pretty much pioneered distributed workplaces, and his work has always been marked by thoughtfulness and intellectual rigor, especially basing decisions on verifiable research and data. He continues to break new ground with his consulting firm, Eight Corners Consulting." So, Eric, thank you so much for agreeing to sit down and talk with me today and be a part of this podcast.
You are welcome.
You know, I've mentioned that we worked together at Sun. How do you describe what you did and achieved at Sun to people who don't know you?
Well, as you know, it's hard to describe because what we do, what we developed, doesn't fit neatly into any established profession or line of work. So what I say is that we develop systems of support for diverse groups of knowledge-based workers. And then, of course, I have to start saying, oh, what do I mean by systems of support? And by systems of support, we mean all the policies, you know, HR policies, management policies, all the technical infrastructure, the devices, the software, the applications, the infrastructure capabilities, and then all the physical places, both within a Sun location or a corporate location and outside of some corporate locations. All those things can form a system. And then I have to really describe what I mean by that, which means they aren't just randomly selected policies and places and technologies. It's elements that are selected to work together in order to support whatever it is that a particular work group or workforce is trying to do. So that's what we created. We created systems of support for the way people either work or the way they strive to work in order to accomplish the things that they need to do as individuals and as groups.
So I know most people, when they think of iWork or they think of what we did, just think of the flexible work part of it, the work from anywhere part of it, which I know is not it's only a very small part of the whole thing. Do you think is that a problem that people look at it that way or think of it that way?
Well, sure. I mean, it's interesting. Different people look at what we did with different lenses. I mean, as you probably remember, our CFOs, the several that we had over a period of time, looked at this as really a way to manage a certain area of costs. Other people, interestingly enough, oftentimes those who weren't readily in support of what we were doing thought it was just a way to let people work from home. And other people would say, oh, well, this is just work-life balance. And some people would think that was important. People would think it was not important. But, and then the flexible piece, just to describe what that was, well, flexibility meant a lot of things, but in some people's minds, it meant that instead of having an office that had their name on it, they could use any office. They could move around a certain building or a certain campus of buildings or a certain metropolitan area flexibly. And of course, the program was all of those things and more.
Right.
The program really had to do with enabling people or allowing people to do things with whom, you know, and when and where they themselves thought was best to do the work that they needed to do in the best ways that they thought they could do. The way I think of it now is we created a stage, and then people could do whatever they wanted to do on that stage. But the stage enabled a wide variety of things.
What areas that we did were particularly new or moving things along or changing the way people work and or reflected not just following the way people work, but were they leading it?
Well, you know, really and truly, because, you know, every little piece that we used, I think, had been invented by somebody else pretty much. I mean, we may have refined it so it was particular to Sun, but certainly there were work from home programs before we came along, and certainly people were using the internet. Of course, actually, when we started, there wasn't an internet, which was a problem in itself, but in 1995. But, you know, I think it was one of the big consulting firms that started using hoteling. We weren't the first ones to do that. Our unique contribution was twofold. One was we developed ways of understanding work practice that I think was unique and a huge contribution is now being picked up in all sorts of places. I see it all the time now. And that is giving people within a corporate world or organizational world degrees of freedom, degrees of choice that were really unheard of.
Mm-hmm.
And so those things, you know, mapping support systems of support to work practices and saying, you know, why is it that when people are in college, they have a lot of freedom to organize their days to do what they need to do. And then as soon as they get in the workforce, all of a sudden they're in kindergarten again.
Right.
I mean, it doesn't make sense,
yeah.
Particularly with a knowledge-based workforce. So I think if I think of our real contributions, I think those were those contributions.
That makes sense. What do you think were the, what do you think are the biggest successes that we achieved in the iWork program? And maybe that kind of the same things you were just saying.
Well, it was those things, but you know, when I think about it, it is, you know, for a workforce, and when this was, of course, Sun, you know, before the Oracle stuff and before its a decline, but Sun is a 40,000 person workforce. You know, when you think about it, nearly 100% of the workforce used elements of our program, and about half of the workforce, you know, 20,000 or so, were fully signed up in the program. And, you know, I think you probably remember some of the kinds of comments and commentary we would get from people.
Oh, absolutely.
The one that sticks in my mind, amongst quite a few, but one that sticks in my mind was from a software engineer who wrote an email to Crawford Beveridge, who was our executive VP of HR at the time, and said, I cannot leave Sun. I am a captive of the Sun work style. And essentially that meant that we had captured the loyalty of some key employees.
Yeah, I think especially over the last few years when Sun's gone through so much difficult times, it had to have made an enormous difference to the ability to keep the best and the brightest, I think.
The program, I think, has helped keep the workforce together longer than it might have.
Right.
And I, of course, it preserved to some extent cash.
Right.
because we know that it preserved cash. And even though for me that was never the most important part of the program, the reality is that it saved the company, you know, $50, $60, $70 million a year.
Right. So why do you think some people were so resistant, and I think some people even today are probably resistant to having their organizations or their staff work in a flexible environment?
Well, I mean, I'll just guess it's some, well, it's more than guessing. I mean, I know. I mean, in the world of engineers, there are some engineering managers, I think particularly those who came of age and did their first engineering work in the 60s and 70s, maybe into the 80s, you know, really believe that engineers do their best work when they're all physically together.
Mm-hmm.
We used to hear John Chambers at Cisco talk about that. Eric Schmidt has continues to talk about that. Or at least I saw an article within the past couple of years where he bemoaned the fact that Google can no longer fit in one place. You know, and so it's their tradition. Without really thinking through what that means or without actually checking in with their own engineers to see what that means. I think that another is that the program really does require good managers. And it doesn't really require managers to do things significantly differently if managers are doing the things they should be doing in the first place, like creating clear expectations, creating clear objectives, you know, having regular discussions with the people in their group, doing regular evaluations, all those kinds of things, attending to conflict quickly, trying to help resolve those conflicts. I mean, to the extent that those things don't happen, then when you begin a flexible or distributed work program, all those things come in high relief.
Right.
And then there can be real trouble. And so managers who don't naturally do those things or have never learned to do those things don't want to do that. I mean,
they
run into trouble.
Right.
And as you know, I mean, managers who kind of naturally did those things could transition into this situation really quite easily.
Right. Now, we talked, I think last time we talked a little bit about how some problems are like chess problems that can be solved in a, you know, systematic way, and others are much more complex, like, you know, global warming or deciding whether to send troops into Afghanistan. Obviously, the problem of how to create a more productive work environment is a less urgent problem than climate change or war, but it certainly was a complex problem. What have you learned about the planning and problem-solving process that can help solve these kinds of problems?
You know, our friend Joe Oway introduced me to a mentor of his, I mean, to the writings of a mentor of his, a guy named Horst Riddle, J-O-R-S-T Riddle, who was a systems thinker and urban planner in the 60s, I think, and 70s, and wrote widely. Anyway, he coined the term wicked problems, as opposed to, in contrast to, tame problems. And tame problems aren't necessarily easy problems. It's just that tame problems are problems for which there's an answer.
Right.
Wicked problems are problems for which there are no answers, no specific answers. There's no, you can't say, oh, there's the right answer with a wicked problem. In the world of supporting work, as I think anything in the world of human behavior, there's no one right answer. And so all you can do is get things as good as you can get them for the time being, and then be willing to watch how that evolves and change. And that's exactly what we ended up doing because we had no choice. When we started the program in 19, or the whole effort, not knowing really where it was going to go in 1995 or so, we had no model. We didn't, I mean, all we knew was we we wanted to learn how to support work better. As you remember, you may remember, it was originally called the Work Effectiveness Group, and we wanted to help people become do their best work, mm-hmm. and we wanted to support that. But we didn't know how to do it, and it turned out that it's totally complex because it has to do with human behavior and the diversity of human beings. You know, everything from the cultures that they're in to their particular personalities to their particular family situations to their particular group situations, the nature of the work that they're doing, the kinds of problems they're trying to solve. There's no one answer.
Right, right.
And the interesting thing is that the tradition is to give one answer. You know, here's a set of cubes. Come in here anytime between 8 and 9:30 and leave anytime between, you know, 5 and 7 p.m. and thank you.
Right.
And that's the support system. And, you know, that one answer is not an answer either.
Right.
And I think what we came to acknowledge was that for certain people under certain circumstances, that actually might be an answer. And that's fine. But it's a choice. It's one of the stage includes that as one answer. And then there's lots of other possible answers. And you just have to provide those choices. You have to provide enough sets of choices to hopefully satisfy the needs of the vast majority of the workforce without knowing really how they will use those choices.
That makes sense. And like you, so you're saying, and continue to monitor how it goes and adjust as you're going along, then you're saying.
Yeah, you've got to jump in. I mean, the worst thing under this circumstance is to say, well, we can't do anything until we really know all the answers, because
right.
you're never going to know all the answers.
I think one of the biggest things I learned from working with you is the importance of basing decisions, you know, on verifiable research and data. Why do you think that's so important, and what do you say to people who claim that decision-making should be more intuitive and that problems are too complex to reduce to data?
Mm. Well, it's interesting because it's both things, both points of view are true, I think. The point of the data, let's see, if you can picture this kind of a graphic, I've used this graphic in the past year in a couple of presentations, because I think it explains some things. There's a spectrum on the left side is there's a line. A horizontal line. On the left side, on the top of the line, is picture and individual. And at the bottom, below the line, is something that represents a short time increment, like, you know, an hour or a minute or an hour or something like that. And all the way at the other end of the spectrum, at the top of the line, picture something that represents a large group of people. 50, 100, 1,000, 10,000
mm-hmm,
people.
Right.
And at the bottom of the line at that end is a calendar representing months or a year, you know,
right,
a long
right.
time cycle. The point of the data is to understand the right-hand side of that.
Okay.
Because on the right-hand side, what I can say with great degree of confidence that what the portfolio of choices needs to be is very, very similar across organizations, across cultures, across kinds of knowledge work. I mean, engineering, marketing, HR, corporate functions, and so on. And so what the data does, it tells you what your portfolio of possibilities needs to be. At the other end, you can't predict. I mean, so at that right end, at that scale of group and at that scale of time, things are predictable. And that's what the data has told us, and it tells us that over and over and over again. At the left hand of the scale, at the more individual scale and at shorter increments of time, what is going to happen is very unpredictable. You cannot say, oh, that individual is going to be doing that over that hour. You just can't. individual work or group work or informal collaborative work or checking out for a while or whatever.
Right.
You just can't predict it. And so, you know, in a sense, the intuitive part is just to say, you know, each individual is going to make the right choices for themselves. You just have to provide the palette of choices so that they can make those choices, and you have to be able to support those choices, and then things will turn out well.
That makes sense.
Yeah. That's why I think, you know, the intuition is important, but so is the data.
So, what would you like to do in the future to kind of continue to expand your knowledge about and experiences with workplace design and problem solving?
Well, at Sun, you know, because we didn't fit neatly into any one group, in any one profession. I mean, we were architects and technologists and IT people and people with sociological background and marketing backgrounds and sort of very cross-disciplinary. Because we didn't fit in one group, what we had to do was we had to hook on to events of one sort or another in order to implement our program. And the events we hooked on to at Sun, because at the time we were developing this, Sun was growing very rapidly, were real estate events. Now, what I'm interested in is using the technologies that have developed over the last several years, because I think that those technologies present opportunities that we did not have.
Right.
Even up to the time that I retired. I mean, the social networking technologies, the new video capabilities, the new interactive stuff, even the way you and I are using Skype right now. I mean, these are all new. And, for me, as I think about distributed work, even though there are aspects of it that are hard for people to adopt, like coming to formal agreements amongst a team or group so that everybody knows when people will be present and all that kind of stuff, that's not rocket science. There's no mystery in it. You just have to do it.
Right.
You have to get in the habit of doing it. It's like sort of like cleaning your room. You know, you might not want to do it, but it's better if you do. The mystery, I think, has continued to be the particular work pattern that is, I'm doing heads down individual work. Whoops, I've got a question. I need a 2-minute interaction with somebody. I need to find out if somebody's available. I need to do a quick piece of research, and I need an expert resource for that research. Or I just feel like saying hello to somebody real quickly. Now, how do you do those things over distance?
Right.
And I think the technologies that are emerging now are enabling that. And so what I'm doing now in some new work is exploring those technologies and implementing them in distributed work situations to see if that kind of frequent, very short, informal interactions that are all interlaced with individual heads down work can be done as effectively across distance as it is when people are physically together.
That makes a lot of sense. I think it's clear that the technology is just making it, well, more and more people are doing it, you know, on their own anyway. So just working from everywhere, it becomes so much easier.
That's right. And I'm having an opportunity to do some of those things myself, you know, as I work from home with colleagues and so on in Massachusetts or in Arizona or elsewhere, California or Colorado. What I'm finding is it's fun to do those quick informal things using technology.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually, I'm finding it to be very effective.
Yep, I totally agree with you. Totally. So totally on a different front here. Now, I know you've done a lot of hiking in, you know, I've got Italy and Spain and Peru and Argentina in the last few years. Do you have a favorite place you've hiked?
Of course, we always love to hike here in the Sierra. I have to, every one of those is so amazing. The Dolomites are amazing. The Pyrenees were incredible. the Andes were amazing because once you got hiking, you don't see civilization as we know it. We see civilization as some of the Peruvians know it, but it's very, very different. Very different. So what I love is every mountain range is different. And it's a different experience. If I had to really, really, really choose a favorite, man, that'd be tough. That would really be tough. It'd probably be either the Pyrenees or the Andes. But I have to say the Dolomites and
Now the Dolomites are in Italy, is that right?
it's between Venice and Austria in
All
the
right.
northern part of Italy.
That was your most recent trip?
Yeah, that was our most recent trip.
So, what
Yeah.
stands out for you about that trip?
Well, it was the diversity of the Dolomites themselves. I mean, it was the way I describe think of it when I first saw it, and as we were hiking through it, it was like, for people who are familiar with California, if you take in the summertime, or in the spring, let's just say the springtime, yeah. If you take the greenness of the Central Valley, the Sacramento Valley, and the drama of the mountain sides with still snow on them in the Sierras, and you cut out all the foothills, just cut out the foothills and slam the green valley up against the dramatic rises of the mountains and the snow. That's what the Dolomites are like. It is like green valley with steep mountain sides and snow.
Wow.
It's just breathtaking, the dramatic nature of it. And then you'll get into other areas where it's just really incredibly beautiful green rolling hills and smaller mountains. So the diversity of all that was terrific.
So, what do you think makes for really good? I know you've gone with groups on most of these trips. What do you think makes for a really good group hiking trip?
Well, it's interesting. We on some of these we just go with a couple that are good friends, so it's just the four of us, and that always makes a really good hiking trip because we get along.
Right.
Interestingly enough, just to give you a contrast, in the Pyrenees, it was a we arranged the trip fairly quickly, so we joined a group of a dozen people, and we didn't know anybody. And it was so much fun that we all got along so well. I mean, it was just so compatible that was very, very enjoyable. Whereas the hike in the Dolomites, we weren't able to convince any of our friends to come along. So we were in a group that was only turned out to be six people. And out of the other four, truthfully, we weren't all that, simpatico, you know what I mean?
Yes, right.
It wasn't like conflicts or anything. It just wasn't. I mean, there were different kinds of, they had different abilities in terms of hiking, different priorities.
Right.
One couple, really all they wanted to do was take photographs. Another couple just weren't really in that good shape. And so it was kind of limiting.
Yeah.
So, either I think you want to be in a big group where there's diversity of people, and you can always find people who you match up with,
Right.
or you want to be with friends
Well, that's
or
yep.
yourself.
That makes sense. That makes sense. So, what was the biggest challenge going from the corporate executive role to your current role? Or how do you describe yourself? As I guess you've got your own business. You're an independent businessman.
Yeah, I'm a consultant. Well, I mean, I'm a grandfather.
Right.
That's first thing, really. I mean, we spend time with our grandkids. I'm now involved with our community here in Kirkwood as on the board of directors for our public utility district, which is the only elected body here in Kirkwood. It's the only agency that represents all of Kirkwood, actually, since Kirkwood spans three counties. And then I'm a consultant and a partner to various people in that being a consultant. I mean, it really blends all the things I love to do. I mean, even as a executive at Sun, I think, I was never happy not rolling up my sleeves and doing
Right,
stuff.
right.
I mean, the last thing I wanted to do was spend all day, every day in meetings, just doing that corporate thing. And I'll tell you, being out of that environment for the past 3 years just shows me everything that's wrong. I mean, I just have a sense of everything that's wrong with the corporate world.
Right.
I mean, and you know, those worlds operate partly because they have to operate that way when they're so big. But you can really see how much time is wasted and how much resource and energy is wasted. It really is just so much easier to do things.
Has being out of that environment for 3 years changed any of your or given you any real insights into designing work, workplaces?
No. I mean, not particularly. I mean, you know, in the end, at Sun, we were most successful when we were working with specific groups, you know, like the software group in Prague or the sales organization in a particular place. And it was always the hardest when we were working at the highest executive levels trying to convince people to allow something to happen.
Right.
So, you know, I've not gained any, I mean, insights particularly. I mean, I wouldn't know what the world should be other than the corporations. I mean, the business world.
Right.
I think there does have to be scale.
Yeah.
Probably to get big things done. But it's sure easier when it's smaller.
Right. Yeah. Have you consciously designed your balancing the different roles in your current consulting role and what you want to do and structured where you are today? Or do you think it's kind of evolved with just a general idea of where you want to go?
You know, truthfully, after leaving Sun and thinking that I was retiring, truthfully, I got bored. I mean, I enjoyed the time with grandchildren, the one grandchild at the time, but that was only, one small part of every week. And I really got restless. So I was definitely open to opportunities, and some opportunities have come along. So it's not just random. I'm not taking any opportunity that comes along.
Right.
There are some very good opportunities that really do extend what we were doing at Sun in the areas that I've talked about, particularly distributed group work is what I'm far more interested in right now. You know, how do groups work together across distance and how is that supported? So I think there's good business opportunity there, good consulting opportunity, and certainly a lot of good intellectual opportunity.
Yeah.
To learn.
What kind of advice do you give people who ask you about retirement and whether how to make it work? Or,
geez, I don't give advice.
Well, that's probably smart.
Nobody's really asked me. I don't call it retirement, but I think this is common. I mean, I think this is a common thing is that you develop a set of diverse things to do. You know,
right.
Three or four major kinds of things that really makes for an interesting life.
Right.
I mean, it's the civic work. I was doing some nonprofit work, the consulting work, you know, family stuff, which is so important to me. I mean, it's a great combination.
Yeah, definitely.
I feel very lucky.
Oh, that's awesome.
Very lucky.
Well, thank you, Eric, very much for agreeing to do this today. This has been fun. I've enjoyed talking with you. You do a lot of exciting stuff.
Yeah, it's always great to talk to you, Marian.
Thanks. I have a few additional comments before I end this edition of the Marian Vermeersen podcast. I've put a couple of Sun iWork links in the show notes, and the show notes also include a link to the Horst Riddle Melvin Weber Wicked Problem article that Eric mentioned. And I've also put a link to an article on wicked problems from Wikipedia. I'd like to thank Eric for taking the time to have this conversation with me. I'm proud to have been a part of the work we did at Sun and to have been a part of the team that created the iWork program. It was fun to talk with Eric about it. The music at the beginning and the end of this podcast is the Latin Project playing Dizzy Gillespie's jazz standard, A Night in Tunisia. If you have feedback about this show, please email me at marian.vermeersen@gmail.com or put a comment on my podcast blog at marianvermeersen.blogs.com/mv-podcast. Thanks for listening.